Hello, I'm delighted to say that this episode of Film Stories is sponsored by NordVPN. Now, if you're unfamiliar with a VPN, it is a virtual private network, and it's a service that basically allows you to pretend that your computer or device is in a different country. So you set a virtual location for your device, and that means that suddenly you can get access to things that otherwise you might not be able to see. So for instance, if you're a Netflix subscriber, you set your NordVPN to America, then you get a plethora of options from American Netflix rather than UK Netflix, which is where this podcast is based. You can do this with all sorts of things. You switch the virtual location of your VPN service, and then you get access to TV shows, to films, to sporting events, streaming services and such like that you just wouldn't be able to get from the UK. A quick mention too for the cybersecurity features of NordVPN, including shielding your online activities, encrypting your connection, and using threat protection as well. To take advantage of this, you need to go to nordvpn.com/filmstories. That's nordvpn.com/filmstories. And you can try it risk-free with a 30-day money-back guarantee to get the best discount off your NordVPN plan. If you go to that Film Stories link, that will give you an extra 4 months free on top of the 2-year plan. And again, there's no risk with Nord's 30-day money-back guarantee. And you will also find the link in the podcast episode description box. Hello, this is Simon Brew. I'm the editor of Film Stories magazine, and a very warm welcome to the Film Stories podcast. As this is the last podcast before I go on my summer break, I thought I'd break with tradition and I'd play a clip for you right from the start. A clip of the late, great Sean Connery. He's promised me he won't swear. If he does, I might have to take action. Over to you.
Your best. Losers always whine about their best. Winners go home and...
Come with me.
And I show you how deep the rabbit hole goes.
In movies. Movies that had stories.
That the story just sucks them in.
This is just the beginning.
Stories. We would be honored if you would join us.
Hello and a very warm welcome to Film Stories with Simon Brew. I am Simon Brew. As always, that's all you need to know about me. The aim of the podcast, though, well, I'm here, as the title suggests, to talk of the stories of films. And I talk about development stories, production stories, marketing stories, release stories, all the bits and bobs, really, that go to make the films that we know and sometimes love just that, the films that we know and sometimes love. The films I tend to choose for this podcast, well, they've got more of a mainstream leaning than anything else. They're films I'm interested in or invested in to some degree. I try not to punch down. I try not to do snark. It's really difficult to make a film. I just want to celebrate those who've been able to do so. Without further ado, I'm going to have another run at introducing the first of the two films I'm going to talk about in this episode of Film Stories. I'll play you a slightly less fruity clip. I'll come to the story the other side of this.
It's a hostage situation on Alcatraz.
Hostage, 81 tourist.
The Rock's a tourist attraction.
The one you train to defend you becomes your greatest threat.
A battery of VX gas rockets is presently deployed to deliver a highly lethal strike on the population of the San Francisco Bay Area.
And the one you abandon becomes your only hope.
You go talk to him.
Me?
Yeah.
Hiya. I'm an agent with the FBI. I'm Stanley Goodspeed.
But of course you are.
At least he got his name right.
Now, all that stands between a city and a disaster.
The power of this chemical is way beyond anything you can imagine.
That's why you're coming with us.
Is a man who's never seen combat.
You're a chemical freak. I'm a chemical super freak, actually.
And another who's been out of action for 30 years.
Show us on the blueprints.
I can't. My blueprint was in my head.
Fortunately, some things you never forget.
But don't worry. It'll all come back to me.
That then is a clip from 1996's The Rock, directed by Michael Bay. Screenplay in the end credited to David Weisberg, Douglas Cook and Mark Rosner. Story by Weisberg and Cook. The cast, led by Sean Connery, Nicolas Cage, Ed Harris, Michael Biehn, William Forsythe. They're the ones leading the sizable ensemble for it. But the story of The Rock actually began with a spec script. Now, I've talked about spec scripts a little bit, so apologies if I'm doing a recap of what you already know. A spec script script in Hollywood is when a writer writes something where it's not been commissioned, it's not been paid for. They write it on spec with the hope of selling it to someone and thus making themselves very rich. That's usually how it's supposed to work. It doesn't always. So David Weisberg and Douglas Cook, well, they're the ones who came up with the original idea for the film, and they were the ones who put that spec script together. Now, they'd first met at Phillips Exeter Academy in the US in 1974, and it took a while for their writing partnership to form, but it did, and over the course of their career, they'd penned Double Jeopardy, for instance, the Ashley Judd, Tommy Lee Jones thriller, Criminal, remember that one with Kevin Costner? It's one of Costner's finest. But they undertook research into chemical weapons and such like. They fashioned a very serious action film as it was originally, and they came up with the nucleus of the idea for what would be The Rock. Now, their script that they put together then got picked up by Disney for its, for Caravan Pictures, which was a production company set up at Disney at the time. That was under the stewardship of Joe Roth, who would go on to head up Disney later on in the 1990s. At this point, he was producing films like, I think, The Three Musketeers with Kiefer Sutherland. Remember that one? I think that was one of his. But Roth looked at the script and then he decided it was probably better suited for the sensibilities of Uber producers Jerry Bruckheimer and Don Simpson. Now, this was around the early 1990s, really. So Bruckheimer and Simpson were coming off the very bloated production of Days of Thunder in 1990. They hadn't recaptured the magic quite of Top Gun, which is the thing that had put them on the top of the Hollywood tree. But at the point that they got the script, they were working on a film called Crimson Tide, which I've covered before, and I love Crimson Tide an awful lot. And so whilst they were finishing Crimson Tide off, they started the process of employing lots and lots and lots and lots and lots and lots of writers to fashion the script into the script of The Rock into something that they could work with. Mark Rosner, for instance, he was hired for a rewrite, and even though the script was consistently in flux, they began starting to crew the project up, that this was going to be their next film after Crimson Tide. Now, what was suspected but not known particularly at this point was that the Bruckheimer-Simpson relationship, which had been going on for a decade or so and had brought huge amounts of money and success, well, that was getting fractured, that Simpson's quite legendary, it's been detailed extensively in the Hollywood trade press and in an excellent book as well, Simpson's legendary drug habit was really starting to make his behaviour even more erratic. And on the set of Days of Thunder, there were stories, and I haven't come to this in a podcast yet, but I will at some point, about how that film was more party than film for an awful lot of people. Nonetheless, the Rock that they chose to pursue and move ahead with, I mean, it was almost an end of an era movie, really. And for Arnold Schwarzenegger, it could have been the start of a whole new era, because he was one of the first actors to be sounded out about starring in the film. The version of the movie that he ultimately was sent, certainly the script of it, and he revealed this in a Reddit Ask Me Anything session, was about 80 pages long, and he didn't really care for what he saw, and he would turn it down, and he would come to regret turning it down. But at that point, there just wasn't an awful lot on the page. Now, this didn't dissuade one of the eventual stars, Nicolas Cage, who we didn't know at the time, but he was key to unlocking the rest of the casting of the movie. Cage was coming off the back of winning an Oscar for Leaving Las Vegas. Throughout the early 90s, he'd done a mix of vaguely commercial stuff, Honeymoon in Vegas, It Could Happen to You, and more serious stuff, and more acclaimed stuff, Wild at Heart, obviously. But he wanted to work with Simpson and Bruckheimer. He wanted to do a big Hollywood action movie. He was really tempted by this. And it's pretty well known that Cage would go on to do basically this trilogy of Hollywood action movies back to back, which would be The Rock, Con Air and Face Off. But The Rock was the first of them. Now, Tony Scott, he was mooted originally as the person to direct the film. He was in the midst of making Crimson Tide with Simpson and Bruckheimer. He knew them. He'd known them since Top Gun. But he was committed to doing a film called The Fan, starring Robert De Niro at that point. So he was out. And so coming into the frame was a young up-and-coming director by the name of Michael Bay. Now, Bay had already been hired by Simpson and Bruckheimer to do bits of work on Days of Thunder. And he'd scored a hit with his directorial debut, the film Bad Boys, starring Will Smith and Martin Lawrence. There was a premiere article around the time The Rock was released where Bay was quite down on Bad Boys about how he wasn't particularly happy with the script, etc., and that The Rock was basically a bit, an improvement and a step up. But at this point, he was sounded out about whether he would be interested in doing the movie. And the thing is, originally, he wasn't. Now, there was an eventual Criterion Collection DVD of The Rock, which includes an extensive commentary track, which I've greatly enjoyed listening to again. And I've drawn on quite a lot for the stories in this podcast. And on that, for instance, Bay revealed that he turned The Rock down 6 months before he ultimately said yes. He was in the midst of Bad Boys. At the point Simpson and Bruckheimer fully took the Rock over, well, he'd worked with them on Bad Boys. He liked working with them. And they said to him, "We don't have a full script. Would you commit to it? And we will build the story up. We'll build the script up." Now, what that kind of overlooked a little bit was just how tight a turnaround the project would be. That this was being set up at the Disney arm Hollywood Pictures, and it was a big summer blockbuster, just the kind of thing that they were looking for. And so they needed to get cracking, really. And so Bay and Don Simpson at first, they would fax ideas backwards and forwards, and gradually, the skeleton of a new version of the film came together. Now, Nicolas Cage, he was interested, he was signing up, and he wanted to have input into into his character, Stanley Goodspeed, in the film. He argued, for instance, when he saw that the Elton John song Rocket Man was going to be in the film, he just said, well, the character of Goodspeed needed to be into his music. So Cage's contribution was that Stanley Goodspeed, apart from also being called Stanley, was a Beatlemaniac. Cage himself wasn't a fan of CDs and liked vinyl, so they wrote that into the character as well. And Cage knew going into this he was signing up to a film with a script far from finished, and to the point where he'd been working in Hollywood thus far, he'd been basically told that his ideas were crazy and off the wall. Now he found himself working with the likes of Jerry Bruckheimer and Michael Bay, and they were encouraging to him to be crazy and off the wall. He was also, he would admit, drawn to making the film because people were saying, well, you're too quirky to be in blockbuster movies. That, you know, you're more art house stuff. Blockbusters aren't you. And so the gauntlet really was thrown to him there. What he also, he was looking for a contrast after leaving Las Vegas anyway, which is a very heavy role, excellent performance as well. What he was surprised by was that Don Simpson was a fan of a Cage film that not many people really had watched called Guarding Tess, and that was about him playing a frustrated Secret Service agent, and producer Don Simpson was thinking, well, that's who Goodspeed should be. But again, Cage tried to turn it round, and successfully so. It's just like, well, why not have him actually loving his job? Why not make that part of the character? Unbeknownst to Nicolas Cage, one person who really wanted to work with him was Sean Connery. Now, Sean Connery, at this point of the story, early to heading towards the middle 90s, his career was sort of back in a small lull. That towards the end of the 1980s, he'd had a real resurgence, that he'd won an Oscar for The Brilliant, The Untouchables. He'd been in a series of hits, Indiana Jones, The Last Crusade, The Hunt for Red October, even Rising Sun, the much maligned Rising Sun, the much maligned Medicine Man. They both sort of did okay. But then gradually, films like Family Business and A Good Man in Africa and Just Cause, they just kind of fizzled a little bit. Now, he was signed up with the CAA agency, Creative Artists Agency, hugely influential agency in Hollywood, particularly in the early 1990s, under the stewardship of Uber agent Mike Ovitz. And he was actively looking for a big, huge project for his client. And so all of this just really, it was kind of coming together. You had Connery wanting to work with Cage, Connery's agents looking for something big for him. And so there was still the problem that the script wasn't there, and there's no way Sean Connery was going to sign on the dotted line until the script was in place. But he was happy to start having conversations. And by this point, writer Jonathan Hensley had been brought in by Michael Bay, and Bay and Hensley would spend months working on the screenplay for this. They would go through it with Connery, trying to tune it, trying to make it better. And Connery brought his own ideas to it as well. I mean, he liked the idea that his character would be someone forgotten by his own government, really. And he called on a couple of writers he'd worked with before, Dick Clement and Ian Lafrenet, who wrote about this in their excellent memoir. because what he wanted was for the character of John Mason to have more Britishness to it. That Connery had really just felt that the lack of Britishness was a problem with the character that needed to be addressed, that the character of John Mason needed some fleshing out as well. And so Clement and Lafrenne started working. I mean, they come into Connery's sphere really on his Bond, his final Bond movie, the unofficial one, Never Say Never Again, where they were brought in to do uncredited work, beefing up the dialogue on that. He'd enjoyed working with them. And they basically bonded up the character of John Mason a bit. So there's a line, I was special services, I'm not doing a Connery impression, I was special services, military intelligence, they taught me to be a killer. In retrospect, I'd sooner have been a poet or a farmer, which I consider infinitely more honourable professions. Stuff like that was brought along by Clement and Lafrenne. The idea that his background was British intelligence, little hints of 007 just being added to the dialogue. Now, Michael Bay and Sean Connery still, of course, needed to meet. And so Bay flew via Concorde from the US to the UK for a meeting in Connery's hotel, 5:30 in the morning on Bay's body clock at that point. He waited for a couple of hours. He didn't have any idea where to go. He was scared of being late. He eventually got to the hotel, found Connery waiting for him, sat in a golf shirt, shook his hand, and the whole thing was starting to come together. And so, but following that, these rewrites could really begin in earnest. So you had Clement and Lafrenne beefing up Connery's stuff. They did a lot of dialogue work. They went beyond their original brief of just working on one character. There was Bay also working with Jonathan Hensley, continuing to flesh this out. You had Nicolas Cage doing more and more research, discovering things like how 8 ounces of poison could take out the world. And he talks about that on the DVD commentary. And he was bringing ingredients into the story. The legendary Hollywood writer Robert Town, he came in to take a look at the screenplay. He backed things like Nicolas Cage's idea of the character of Goodspeed being worried about becoming a father and how they basically develop Goodspeed's character from there, the whole sardonic attitude, the playing a guitar naked. There's one point where Cage just was wearing purple Speedos under his robe. You know, these were the kind of things that Nicolas Cage brings to you. And I mean, Bay was pretty much indulging it. He was quite happy. There was still quite a lot of research that needed to be done, that before production really began, Michael Bay wanted to go and see Alcatraz, Alcatraz Island, where the film is set. And he got to see both the touristy and the non-touristy bits of the Alcatraz prison. He got to see the bits that were basically falling apart that tourists weren't allowed to go near. And he knew when he got there that he needed to shoot a large chunk of his film on this island. There was quite a lot of to-ing and fro-ing, though, to be able to make that happen, because the film was getting more and more expensive. I mean, ultimately, the budget for the film would be $75 million. And Bay, on the one hand, he'd be fighting sort of Bruckheimer, really, for instance, a shot of some helicopters that they'd be looking at it. And Bruckheimer would say, well, there's 2 shots of helicopters. Do you really need them? And they would go backwards and forwards for a month, and they'd meet in the middle on just having one larger helicopter shot. This was, in fact, that ultimately was locked down. That was said to be the last shot before they locked the picture in the end. But also there were the logistics of how do you film on Alcatraz Island. They had to ship over the water. They had to ship over 6 generators for the electricity, 26,000 feet of cable. Bay said it was the biggest cabling job on a Hollywood movie since Terminator 2 Judgment Day. They took an 11-story crane over to the island. Meanwhile, there was also who's going to play Hummel, the villain. And so this is where Ed Harris came in, and he went to Don Simpson's house to get the pitch for the movie. Michael Bay was on the couch in Don Simpson's house. And the conversation, again, it took Harris a month really before he'd commit. And he's really open. He was really open at the time as well about how he struggled with this character, that he had to be right because he can't be the kind of character who ultimately would want to kill 1 million people because that goes against his whole background. He had sympathy for the motivations of the guy, and he would admit he found it really difficult to plan. And as much as he liked his work in the film, he tried really hard to make the character of Hummel believable in an unbelievable situation. That he worked an awful lot on dialogue, he worked an awful lot on character, and he just had to be right. Further screenwriters were still getting involved. And this, I mean, this is a modus operandi to a degree too for Bruckheimer and Simpson at the time. I mean, Quentin Tarantino was asked to have a look, for instance. Tarantino had done a little bit of very obvious, glaringly obvious punch up work on the Crimson Tide script. Aaron Sorkin, who I talked about in a very recent episode of this podcast with A Few Good Men, he came in to do some work on the dialogue. Clement and Lafrene, meanwhile, they were still involved. In fact, they were asked along to the rehearsals for the film in the early autumn of 1995, and they were continuing to tune it, and they would ultimately be on set as well. They just kept working throughout the bulk of the movie. Production then was ready to start in earnest on the 30th of October 1995, and this was a much bigger canvas for Michael Bay, a significant upgrade just in scale and budget from that of Bad Boys, and he'd spent the money for Bad Boys really quite well, but he wanted to give himself a ton of options. I mean, what we know about Michael Bay now, none of this I would suggest would particularly come as a surprise, but he wanted to shoot an awful lot of coverage. He shot tons and tons and tons of material. He wanted lots of camera moves. He wanted to use lots and lots of shots to build the film up. And he said in one point in the commentary that this all looks like a John Woo movie. And I think in that he was looking more at the use of slow-mo and the big blasting explosions that he holds at multiple frames per second. The logistics, though, of trying to do this at Alcatraz were still continuing because Alcatraz is a tourist attraction. They were having to work around the tourists that were still on the island, and the bulk of the shoot would take place there. Cage, meanwhile, I mean, he would talk about, even when he was on the set, that he didn't think anybody really knew how he was going to revamp the character of Goodspeed. That, you know, he discusses this on the commentary track, actually, over the only sex scene in the movie, that he talks there about how much he loves writing and how he's really keen to have input. And I guess it was an irony for him, really, that he had to go to a gigantic film to have this level of input on one individual character. There were stories that Connery and Bay didn't necessarily get on, but Bay refutes this, really. And Connery would go on to say this was one of his preferred films of the 1990s. He did suggest to Michael Bay to slow down, to rehearse more. Bay argues in the commentary that he never underestimated Sean Connery, that the pair of them both disliked BS, that rather than shoot, he kind of slowed it down a little bit for Connery. Bay wanted him as well to play the character of Mason like a rusty James Bond. And this appealed too to Sean Connery, the idea of playing James Bond without being James Bond. Bay nonetheless was conscious that one of his stars was, well, he didn't want to mess him around, and he would be described as very tough on the crew throughout the shoot of this one. So he was tough on the crew, getting everything ready for the point where Sean Connery was due to arrive every day on set, that Bay wanted everything ready. He didn't want Connery to come onto the set and then be kept around waiting, that if there was any kind of technical delay, he would get a message sent, or he'd go off to Connery's trailer and just explain that we're running a little bit behind, and he tried to just play it completely straight with him, which by the sounds of it, Connery appreciated. Connery wasn't as keen on doing some of the underwater stuff. And in fact, there was a story that stomach flu went around the set at one point, because there's an underwater sequence where Connery has to go underwater, and the set is, he insisted on the set, basically, the water in there being heated to a certain temperature, which in turn turned out to be the source of a stomach flu bug that went round as a result of that. Meanwhile, Cage was still having fun. He changed the name of his character from Bill Goodspeed to Stanley Goodspeed. This appealed to Connery. He liked the idea, as Cage described, of it kind of being a Laurel and Hardy idea. There are two characters in there. Cage also brought to it, I think this is ingenious as well, the notion that Stanley Goodspeed would never swear, and he doesn't. That there's plenty of F-bombs throughout The Rock, but none of them come from Cage's mouth, and instead you hear Goodspeed saying things like, oh gosh, and stuff like that. The Alcatraz block of shooting came first. Then there was the extensive car chase that takes place in San Francisco around, 40 minutes into the movie. And this was not a happy time for Michael Bay, that they could only get permission to shoot in a 2-block radius in San Francisco. In return, they had to get thousands of signatures of permission. They had to give free parking to residents. They sorted free dry cleaning for residents as well. But also, what that small geographic space in San Francisco meant is for the car chases. The cars didn't even have an awful lot of run-up to be able to gather speed in the first place. Nonetheless, over the course of their time in San Francisco, they did get the chase sequence in the can, and Bay was operating camera as well, and he says he makes car sounds when he operates the camera in car chases. And the San Francisco bit fell behind by a few days, and this alerted the paymasters at Disney to the point where he was hauled to a studio meeting. And this story came out, and it's in the commentary, but it came out particularly in the light of Sean Connery's passing, that Bay was talking to Connery and says, look, I've got to go and meet the executives at Disney and just have a meeting with them. They're going to want to cut things back. Connery offered to go along with the then young director, walked in to the shock of the Disney executives, shook their hands and said, you can't blame Bay for this running behind. We just need more money. And the shocked Disney executives duly signed off on this one. That said, there was still tug of war over shooting days and budget. That Disney knew this film wasn't going to be cheap, but Bay also was not shy about spending money and, to be fair to him, putting that money on the screen. There was a moment involving a submarine moment that Disney threatened to pull a scene at one point, and Bay describes how he walked off the set for a couple of hours. He did this an awful lot in Pearl Harbor as well, which I think was the last film he made with Disney. I've covered Pearl Harbor in a previous podcast. Disney at that point, well, Michael Bay wasn't the powerful director to the degree he was now, threatened him with a $60 million lawsuit. It'd be fair to say the two didn't always get on, but Bay was ultimately persuaded to return. I mean, one of the delights of the commentary as well is just they're so happy to punch holes through everything. I mean, he would note in the commentary track, Michael Bay, that at one stage the boilers of Alcatraz are still firing, even though the prison has been deserted for a long time and not used. And he knew at the time, even he was shooting this, that this was a plot hole. What he reconciled was, yeah, it looks cool though. Filming wrapped up on the 22nd of February 1996. It didn't leave a huge amount of time for post-production. And that aforementioned Premiere article very much paints a picture of an exhausted Michael Bay trying to get the film in time for the release date Disney had inked in of June 1996, June the 7th. It did give them time to preview the film, though. And they previewed it at one point without that aforementioned huge chase through San Francisco, that there was a feeling that it kind of slowed the film down to a degree. But Bay argued that without that scene, the movie wasn't quite working. It was all kind of jumping a little bit too much, and they needed to strengthen the character of Mason just a little bit there. And so he had to fight to keep that in. And his argument to the executives was he wanted that sequence as much to bring the younger audience back into the film at that stage, because in post-production, one of the things he noted was that some scenes were playing for an awful long time. I mean, he talked in the edit about trying to hammer down the running length of scenes, and one scene in particular caused him a lot of problems, which is when all the military advisors gather around a table to discuss the problem and what they're going to do about it. And at one stage, that was running to 9 minutes, and there's a lot of what you describe, I suspect, as necessary exposition in there. And Bay just needed to get that absolutely down to the core. The other big problem, really, before the film came to release, though, was the Writers Guild of America and its arbitration process. That there were a lot of writers on this film, and there was a dispute going on with another big summer movie the same year, The Cable Guy, which I'll come to at another point. But in this case, the credit from the Writers Guild of America was awarded to the screenplay credit, David Weisberg and Douglas Cook. That's pretty normal if you've originated the screenplay, that you get some credit. And Mark Rosner, with story credit to Weisberg and Cook. And the credit was important because of the residuals that you get if you're the credited writer. Bay was aghast that Jonathan Hensley didn't get credit on the movie, and to the point where he wrote an open letter that was in the Los Angeles Times in the end. He says, I have more intimate first-hand knowledge of the evolution of this screenplay than any individual involved in the project, with the exception of producer Jerry Bruckheimer. Thus, I can confidently, knowledgeably state, wrote Michael Bay, that this result is a sham, a travesty. It embarrasses me. No objective person could read Mr. Hensley's shooting draft, compare it to the previous writer's drafts, and come to this conclusion. Now, Weisberg responded in the same article, and he said, what Michael Bay thinks is interesting, but he is not the jury in the case. Obviously, in these cases, people walked away burned and disappointed. I understand that. If we were not recognised the way we thought we were entitled to, we'd be angry ourselves. more sanguine about it were Dick Clement and Ian Lefrene, and they wrote in their book, we didn't get a credit on this one. But crucially, the business, the Hollywood business, knew about our contribution and our stock rose. By the time the film was heading to its release, Don Simpson had succumbed to his addictions, and this would be the last film that would be preceded by the Simpson-Bruckheimer logo. It's the last film also that he was credited on. And it opened on June the 7th, 1996, to really surprisingly good reviews. And not because I don't think The Rock is good. I think The Rock is an absolute hoot. But this was just the kind of film that critics in theory were supposed to like just punch down a little bit on. But as much as there were plot holes and as much as there were gaps in the story, that the combination of Connery, of Cage, of Harris in this movie, and the fact that it just keeps moving and keeps moving, I think this is the very best of Michael Bay's style, married up to a very appropriate project for it. Well, the response was strong. The fact that it runs 2.25 hours, so if you lop the credits off, close to 2 hours, 10 minutes, that kind of helped as well, that it kept moving, and it didn't go on as long as, let's just say, some of Bay's more subsequent work. It's long, as a result, too, been regarded as Bay's best film, as much by Bay as much as anyone else. And the box office, well, it struck gold. I mean, this was an old-style action film coming out in 1996, at the time when we were supposed to be moving towards more special effects-driven stuff, the kind of Jurassic Park. I mean, Dragonheart was in the top five at the point that this film was released. It knocked Mission Impossible off the top of the box office chart the weekend it came out in the US, June the 7th to the 9th. It opened with a 25 million opening weekend. The other films that were about, well, Twister was at number 3, just to give an example of the special effects driven films that were going around. Eddie was at number 5. Do you remember that? The Phantom with Billy Zane at 6. That is coming up on a future podcast. Spy Hard with Leslie Nielsen. The hugely underrated The Truth About Cats and Dogs was in at 10. But The Rock then would stick around for a good chunk of the summer. The Cable Guy came out the week after and just had a small, just displaced it for a week, really, and then almost pretty much came and went. Eraser, The Hunchback of Notre Dame the week after, but The Rock hung in the top 3. It was still in the top 5 by the time Striptease and The Nutty Professor turned up at the end of June. And in the end, the only thing that knocked it out of the top 5 was, again, proving the point about special effects, Independence Day, coming to that in a future one as well. In all, The Rock would gross $335 million worldwide. It hit in America. It hit overseas as well. And there was temporary talk about a sequel to it. And Bay would talk about this about, without wishing to spoil the ending of it, that he was interested in picking it up pretty much exactly where the first film left off. But for reasons, it never happened. And instead, Disney and Jerry Bruckheimer would sign Michael Bay up to another project. That would be Armageddon, and that would go on at that point to be Bay's biggest production and Bay's biggest hit. The Rock, though, still think it's the best that he's done to date. Which brings me to the halfway point of this podcast. As always, I've gone on too long, so I'm going to crack through the bit where I ask you things really nicely. I am a fully independent podcast producer. I don't have a big company. I don't have a marketing budget. In fact, I don't really have a company, really. It is me in a room in the West Midlands where it is sweltering at the moment. If you can support this podcast in any way, 3 ways, really. I'm on Patreon, patreon.com/SimonBrew. You can subscribe to this podcast at your podcast repository of choice, or leave, ideally, a hugely positive review. All 3 ways there help me get the word out, help support what we're doing here. Also, at the point that this is being recorded, I've just finished, or just about to send to the printers, Film Stories issue 27, Film Stories Junior issue 7. They're basically going to the printers the same day, which is mad. Never do that, chums. If you would like any of my magazines, you'll find them at store.filmstories.co.uk, where you'll also find the Sneakers Blu-ray that we did, which I've talked about a lot on previous podcasts. But I'm now going to crack on with the second of the 2 films I'm going to talk about in this episode. I'm going to just move forward a few years to 2000. We're going to go underwater. Let me just play you a clip. I'll come to the story the other side of this.
Everybody fall in now!
What's going on here?
Hell if I know.
Gentlemen, it's our turn.
In
The last great war.
All ahead two-thirds.
All ahead two-thirds, huh?
A group of young Americans was sent to overpower a Nazi submarine.
The S-33 will rendezvous with a U-boat posing as the German resupply sub.
And steal a secret that could turn the tide of battle.
You'll be all right, son.
Go, 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 go!
You get them their damn trophy and you get the hell out of there.
I found it!
Hirsch, I think we got the code book!
But just when they thought the mission was over...
Success, gentlemen.
They lost their ride home. Submarine.
High speed!
Everything's in German!
I can't equalize the tube!
Deep in hostile waters. The key to victory rests with 9 men.
When they realize what you've discovered, they'll send every ship in the Navy to destroy you.
That then was a clip from the hugely contentious U-571, which came out in 2000, directed by Jonathan Mostow, story by Mostow, screenplay by Mostow, Sam Montgomery and David Ayer, who go on to do things like Suicide Squad and End of Watch. The cast, it's quite a big one. Matthew McConaughey, Bill Paxton, Harvey Keitel, John Bon Jovi, Jake Webber, Eric Palladino, Matthew Settle, David Keith, Thomas Kretschmann, amongst the ensemble for this one. And well, the story of this one goes back quite a long way before we actually saw it, to Jonathan Mostow, that he got his first break in Hollywood shooting an 11-minute horror film as his graduate project. It was a horror film, as he would tell Salon, with exploding eyeballs. And at the point he graduated, he sent letters out all over Hollywood and eventually got a meeting with future Disney boss Michael Eisner. Now, Eisner at this point, this would have been towards the late 80s, early 90s, was still working at Paramount Pictures. It's more late 80s, I think. It was several years, really, before Mostow would get the break into Hollywood. But he would flitter in and out a little bit. He would do bits of work on music videos. He'd do a little bit of work with Roger Corman. And by the end of the 80s, he made just a couple of cheap films, one of which he seems to have pretty much forgotten, Beverly Hills Body Snatchers in 1989, that went straight to DVD. Well, straight to video. There wasn't even DVD then. But the one that put him on the radar a little bit was a low-budget film called Flight of Black Angel that he made for the Showtime Network in the US. Now, what was particular about Flight of Black Angel was it was made on a shoestring but looked more expensive, and that is gold for Hollywood. If you can take a small amount of money and make them look like they've spent tons, brilliant, you're going to get meetings. He got meetings. He also got sent lots of scripts, but nothing grabbed him really. And so after a year of having meetings and seeing scripts, he decided to start developing a project of his own. That project would be The Game. Remember that? The film ultimately made with Michael Douglas in the lead role and David Fincher directing. But originally, it was conceived by Jonathan Mostow. It was going to be directed by Jonathan Mostow. And he actually got a studio interested in it as well. The MGM was at that stage intrigued enough to look at developing The Game. But the story of MGM over the last couple of decades really is one of an organisation in significant financial flux. And so it was never really fully set up with the studio because it couldn't really afford to press it forward. It also felt, because the script for The Game was so offbeat and so and such a leap really, it was the kind of movie that Hollywood believed needed a big star. And so Mostow tried a few people and he nearly got Kurt Russell to star in The Game, but ultimately it wasn't to be. Still, while he did think he was going to make it, he did some location scouting in the San Francisco area, we're back there, and he saw a sign while he was there for a World War II submarine tour, and he talks about this on some of the extras on the Blu-ray release. And whilst he didn't take the tour there and then, it stuck in his head, and he thought there might be a story there. But at this point in Hollywood as well, the idea of writing a film set on water, well, given the production problems that the film Waterworld was going to go through, that didn't seem like a great idea. Meanwhile, The Game's search for a star name had got Michael Douglas interested, and with a big star attached, there was no way it was going to have a rookie director calling the shots. As such, The Game was taken away from him. He would retain an executive producer credit on that film, but it wouldn't ultimately be his film. And so Mostow decided to do to make a strategic choice, and one that paid off spectacularly well, that he would make something cheap. He would write something cheap that he could write and direct himself. He already had a foot in the door with Kurt Russell, and so he made a thriller called Breakdown, which is brilliant if you've not seen it. A really tight, sweaty, claustrophobic thriller as well, which has got shades of The Vanishing to it, without giving too much away. The original Vanishing, not the remake of it, really. But it turned out, not only was Breakdown well received, it was profitable as well. And here was Mostow again. He'd taken something quite economical and he'd made money off it. And now Hollywood was really interested. But also what this had afforded him was basically the path to the next rung of the ladder, that he was given the chance to pitch something bigger, to put something together that got people interested. And so his mind harked back to that submarine, and he went back and he took the tour and he started doing more and more research and got deep into the technicals of World War II submarines and the history of World War II submarines. And he came up with the idea, really, of doing an old fashioned World War II submarine movie, something in that kind of style, really. Now, this was, I mean, it was changing times, really, again. I mean, this is how quick the water shifted in Hollywood in the 1990s, in that suddenly war movies were heading back into vogue. Spielberg was going to do a film called Saving Private Ryan. Remember that? And when Saving Private Ryan was a spectacular hit, well, Terrence Malick would go on and do The Thin Red Line. That would get Oscar nominations. All of a sudden, war films were not box office poison. So this, the project that Mostow was putting together, which would ultimately be U-571, he brought in David Ayer, Sam Montgomery. They worked on the screenplay for it. Legendary producer Dino De Laurentiis, who I talked about on the Flash Gordon podcast a few weeks ago, he was keen to kind of make films in the style he used to, the old World War II and World War II, World War I and World War II films. He brought in Martha De Laurentiis. And all of a sudden, this felt like the right project at the right time. Now, Mostow was then knitting together the story to sit at the heart of it. And crucially, from the off, he wanted this to be fiction. Now, this would cause a lot of problems down the line, as I will come to. But this was not going to be a historical record film. It would certainly capture as much accuracy as it could get. But it was going to be a submarine movie, first and foremost, set in the war. He was going to use the Trojan horse idea that was hinted at in the trailer, the clip that I just played you. He would have been aware of the Enigma machine story that he brought into the heart of his movie and the true history of it, but he wasn't looking to make a true history film. Instead, he was taken by the idea of developing a story of these really young sailors in charge of basically these incredibly powerful submarines. He liked the idea of non-traditional Hollywood heroes, just this young cast, youngsters trying to cope. Now, it's worth noting that Michael Douglas was linked at one stage with starring, ironically enough, in U-571. But he then had a commitment to make a film with Curtis Hanson called Wonder Boys. Matthew McConaughey, meanwhile, he was the big new thing in Hollywood off the back of A Time to Kill, off the back of Contact. And so he would sign up to take the lead role. Edward Norton, he came close to appearing in the ensemble, but he then got financing to make his directorial debut, the excellent Keeping the Faith. And this cast came together. I mean, the experienced hands of Paxton and Harvey Keitel, and then the younger collection, really, John Bon Jovi, Jake Webber, Matthew Seth. And all of a sudden, Mostow had his film in place, this fictional telling of a World War II submarine story that was really, well, it was borrowing enough that wasn't fiction that even at the point it was heading into production, the problems started to mount for the film. Now, filming on U-571, and it got the green light ultimately from Universal Pictures with a budget of around $60 million. This wasn't going to be particularly cheap. It got underway in January of 1999 after the actors had done a bit of work at submarine school and they'd had to watch documentaries. They were given homework to do. They were taken to the set. They had to be able to use a submarine. They also, it's worth noting as well, this one actually got US military support as well. But as that production got underway, a few British tabloids got wind that what the film was doing was taking a crucial event in World War II, the capture of the Enigma machine, and basically shifting the credit, really, from British submarine crew to an American one. This did not go down well. And Mostow would find himself addressing this an awful lot during the production. And he would talk in hindsight about the tabloids printed a story that we were depicting the British incident in 1941, which was the raiding of the U-110. And we were essentially Americanizing the story. So he was very aware of the backlash. He said people over there in Britain got upset. Now, Mostow would reflect that subsequent to the British incident, there were two more occasions where Allied forces went onto U-boats and stole the Enigma. One was the British in 1942, one was the Americans in 1944, and none of these incidents by themselves would have made for a good movie. I would suggest that one or two people tried in the aftermath of this, actually, with some success as well. And so, but Mostow tried to defend it that way, but it wasn't washing, really, even though he said he found a British war hero, Lieutenant Commander David Baum, who led the expedition over to the U-110 in 1941, and they took him to the set, they showed him what they were doing, they showed him the script, and he was very happy with it. But nonetheless, this was all, even at the point it was being shot, this was a film being done under something of a cloud of controversy. It didn't help as well. It was a tricky film to make because U-571, as Mostow would tell Salon, was a real movie of extremes. That half of the film was shot on a soundstage where they had an element of control. The other half was shot out in the water where they were, they were on location. They were prey to the elements that were around them. And so they shot in part in Malta. They shot at Cinecittà Studios in Italy. They shot chunks of it in Hollywood as well. What they also wanted to do was do as much practically as possible. So much so, and the disc extras explore this, they had to build a 600-ton seaworthy vessel that they took out to sea. And they based this on designs from the 1910s. They made it pretty much full size, albeit working from old blurry pictures where the details weren't always that clear. Mostow would argue there wasn't always that much research material to go on when it came to the subs themselves, but nonetheless, they built what they felt was as authentic and close a replica as they could. As is usually the way with submarine films, it was then mounted on a huge gimbal, which would allow them to, they did this with Crimson Tide, that would allow them to rock the boat and tip water over it. They had two 100-foot rain towers, which apparently at the time were the biggest rain towers ever made for a motion picture, so they could keep lobbing loads and loads of water all over it. And this went back to one of the key tenets of the film for Mostow, that he felt that one of the real enemies was actually water. He was also conscious that even though CG was used in the final cut of U-571, it couldn't do everything that he wanted it to do. And as such, there was quite a lot of use of miniatures, but they were miniatures ranging from 50 to 80 feet long. Mostow was also conscious that this was a human-driven film, that he had 15 characters in the movie, and that was a real massive upgrade from Breakdown as well, that each of these characters had to have their place in the story, their place in the film. But going back to the CG, I don't want to spoil the end of the film. It's just there's a bit in Air Force One where a vehicle, let's just say, interfaces with water. And it, to say it blatantly looks like a computer effect would not be an understatement. And that's just the kind of thing Mostow wanted to avoid. Now, filming wrapped up at the end of May 1999, and actually had quite a long time to get the final cut of this ready, that it was due for release in April of 2000. What surprised them, and I wouldn't bring it up apart from the fact that it was brought up by McConaughey, it was brought up by Mostow's, when they started testing the final cut of the cuts of the film, well, the demographic they thought this was going to go for was male, but what they were finding from the test screenings was it was skewing slightly more female, that it was female moviegoers that were more interested in the film. And that's not what they thought they were going to get. And Mostow would talk to Nitrate Online about this. And he said it tested like a women's picture with Bette Midler and Barbara Hershey. Now, I don't know about you, but I, for one, would love to see a submarine movie with Bette Midler and Barbara Hershey. If you're going to throw those words around, I think you really have to back them up. But he said, I don't really understand why, because I see this as kind of a guy picture. And he said the other thing that came out of the film was people feeling patriotic. Now, the original plan with the movie was that it would be R-rated, that it would have a harder edge to it. But as Universal had a little bit of a turn on that, and it was toned down to get a PG-13 to get a broader audience in. And so this took out a decapitation shot of one of the sailors, which was what Mostow would describe as the only true compromise I had to make to get the rating. But also in post-production, there were bits of blood that were digitally removed. And this was stuff that they signed off on because they just wanted to try and get it to a much bigger audience. Now, that plan would be successful. But crucially for U571, certainly in terms of its news coverage, there was a 6-week gap between the US premiere and the UK release. So a couple of things. First of all, the film opened in the US in April of 2000, earned a $19.5 million opening weekend. And so the bottom line was it was a hit. I mean, you look at what else was around that weekend. Love and Basketball opened in second with 8 million, so a long way behind. Rules of Engagement, Samuel L. Jackson in that one, had been number one. That was knocked down to number three with 8 million. 28 Days with Sandra Bullock, Keeping the Faith, the Ed Norton movie, that was at 5. Erin Brockovich was still hanging around at 6. The underrated animated film, The Road to El Dorado, is in the chart. Final Destination, The Skulls, remember The Skulls, crikey. Bottom line, by the time it had crossed over to the UK, U571 was well on its way to getting $77 million in the US, and with the DVD market exploding, it was clearly going to make a profit. However, before the film could make it to UK cinemas, it was brought up in Parliament. It was brought up in the House of Commons, and the then Prime Minister, Tony Blair, said in the House of Commons that he felt the film U571 was, quote, an affront, unquote, to the British sailors that were killed during World War II. And he added, quote, I hope that people realise these are people that in many cases sacrificed their lives in order that this country remained free. They were talking about the fact that the Enigma machine was seen as captured by the Americans in the movie, and the then Culture Secretary Chris Smith said he was intending to raise this issue in with Hollywood executives. He says, I think one of the things we need to make clear to Hollywood is, yes, you're in the entertainment business, but the people who see your movies are going to come away thinking that's information, not just entertainment. And for the UK, by the time the film came to the UK, a caption was added to the end credits, which basically detailed what actually happened involving the Navy, involving the first Enigma machine, and just trying to kind of dampen the backlash and the controversy. It would still be a film that made $50 million outside of the US. I mean, David Ayer, for one, a few years later would say in an interview with the BBC that his grandparents served during the war. He would be upset if someone tried to downplay their achievements. So he did understand the backlash of it. But one thing I would say of the film, just removed from the historical backlash, I think it's a good film. I think it's a really well done film. I think there's a whole subset of really good submarine movies anyway. And for Jonathan Mostow, this would be a film that had a knock-on effect as well, because it would be pivotal to him getting the call to direct the third Terminator movie. In the case of U571, that idea that he had while he was trying to put the game together, and the game proved to be a bit of a hit as well, would go on to gross $127 million and would get decent reviews. The response outside of the historical inaccuracies, and articles about that still come out, was generally positive. But I think were he to have his time again, he might look at it, he might make it a bit more historically accurate, he might cast Barbara Hershey, and he might cast Bette Midler, and just imagine what the film could have been then. Which brings me to the end of this latest episode of Film Stories. It's going to be the last one just for a couple of weeks as well, because, I mean, effectively, this is the end of my third full year of doing this podcast. And so I'm heading into the summer break. There's a huge catalogue of podcasts, I think 191 so far. More than welcome to go through those and have a listen. If you want more of my waffling, you can get it at Simon Brew on Twitter. You can get more from the Film Stories Project at Film Stories Pod. Keep holding on though, because I'm going to tell you something else right at the end of this. Our website is usually updated every weekday, filmstories.co.uk. It's got reviews, it's got features, it's got news, it's got all sorts of movie mayhem. If you go to store.filmstories.co.uk, then you can find all of our magazines, and our Blu-ray as well, the Blu-ray. On Facebook at facebook.com/filmstoriesonline, and on YouTube at youtube.com/filmstories. When this podcast returns in August of 2021, I'm I'm going to give you a bit more information about a very special live event that's been lined up for episode 200, which is currently inked in to record, or penciled in to record on the 8th of September 2021. Information's going to Patreons first at patreon.com/SimonBrew, and then I will bring you the information as soon as it is locked down, and hope that we'll actually be able to see quite a few of you in person. Main thing though, particularly in these times as they carry on, is that you all stay safe and you take care. I thank you as always for your ears. I thank you for your time. You all take care, look after yourselves, and I'll be back in a little bit now with a few more film stories. Bye bye.
This is not combat. It's an act of lunacy, General Sir. Personally, I think you're a fool.